From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. With the price of gas averaging about $2.60 a gallon, even people who haven't been particularly interested in our energy future are getting interested. We rely on Saudi Arabia to pump as much oil as we need and to keep prices reasonable, but critics say the Saudis may not be able to keep up with demand. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Peter Moss about his article, The Breaking Point, which was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. He's writing a book about how oil shapes global politics and the world economy. Cars and light trucks account for roughly 40% of U.S. oil consumption. We'll talk about the latest developments in auto fuel efficiency and design with Mark Phelan, auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles the English band Mötley Crüe. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paying for a tank of gas has become a sobering experience, and it's a good reason to think more seriously about the future of oil. We rely on Saudi Arabia to keep pumping as much as we need, but some experts think that the Saudis might be reaching their peak and prove unable to keep up with the growing international demand. My guest Peter Moss is writing a book about how oil shapes global politics and the world economy. He recently visited Saudi Arabia. His article about Saudi oil, titled The Breaking Point, was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. He's a contributing writer for the magazine. What questions did you set out to answer by doing this piece?
I went to Saudi Arabia to find out really how much oil Saudi Arabia has and how much it can produce on a daily level, because if you can find those answers, then you have a much better idea of whether or not, and this is kind of the big question, whether or not in the years ahead, Saudi Arabia, which is the largest oil producer, will be able to supply not just America but the rest of the world with enough oil to satisfy their demands on a daily basis. And there's a lot of questioning now about whether or not, in fact, Saudi Arabia can do that.
And how does the ability of Saudis to keep up with the demand for oil, how does that affect prices?
It affects prices directly because the Saudis possess about 25% of the world's known oil reserves. And they've always been kind of the central bank of oil in the sense of whenever the world needed more oil, all they did is just kind of flip a few switches and more oil came out of their wells and went into the cars of American and European consumers and factories all over the world. And so if they can't continue increasing the amounts of oil that they produce on a daily basis, then that means that really there won't be enough oil for the world, and that the price of oil as a result, when you have kind of a shortfall between demand and supply, is going to go up because the demand keeps on increasing.
When the Bush administration makes its projections for the future and what our needs will be and whether Saudis will be able to meet those needs, what are they expecting the Saudis to be able to produce in the way of oil? What are the projections that the American government is making?
In a general sense, the American government has always projected that Saudi Arabia will be able to produce as much oil as America requires. And in fact, the Saudis have always said that they will be able to produce as much oil as America and its other clients require. Right now, Saudi Arabia produces about 9.5 million barrels of oil a day. They're promising to increase their daily capacity to about 12.5 million barrels a day by the year 2009. Most people think that they probably can do that, that they can increase production to that level. The real problem is that 12.5 million barrels a day is kind of just a mark that's going to be passed in the next couple of years on a continuum, an upward continuum. And the United States government has these kind of forecasts for the year 2015, for the year 2025, in which Saudi Arabia is kind of slotted in to produce, you know, 15 million barrels of oil a day and then up to 20, 21 million barrels of oil a day. And the problem is that most kind of responsible, knowledgeable oil experts, including some in Saudi that I talked to, say that for Saudi Arabia to produce 15 million barrels a day would really be quite taxing and may not be possible. And anything above that, probably at the current moment with the technology that exists, is not possible at all.
So you've sampled different opinions about what Saudis are capable of producing and how long they'll be able to keep up with need. And you found that it's actually really hard to get real answers to that question. And one has to do with it's difficult to tell how much is really in oil reserves. But the other is secrecy. Where did you run into the secrecy?
I ran smack into the secrecy when I went to Saudi Arabia. I was able to get a visa to go there, which was, you know, a minor triumph. But once I was there, I had hoped to interview officials in the oil ministry, including the minister himself, and then officials in Saudi Aramco, which is the state-owned oil company. In the end, in fact, all of my interview requests were denied by the Ministry of Oil. Nobody in the Ministry of Oil, aside from the spokesman who very reluctantly agreed to speak to me for a very short while. Really, it was pretty much of an information blockade from the Saudis because they had become incredibly sensitive to this question, to the questioning of how much oil they can produce. I mean, they see it on the one hand as being kind of a challenge to their status as the central bank of oil, And they also kind of have followed a policy, as have really all other oil producers, of not letting people know exactly what they have underground, what they are producing on a daily basis. They issue general numbers, but if you ask for the kind of information, seismological information, geological information, how much each well is producing, how much particular wells and particular fields are declining, because they all decline over time, what kinds of methods are being used to recover the oil, because you can kind of tell by the types of methods that are being used how healthy a reservoir is. All these kinds of details, which are absolutely necessary to really understanding how big reservoirs are and how long they continue going on producing oil, all of these details are basically the equivalent of state secrets in Saudi Arabia, as they are in basically all OPEC countries and among virtually all state-owned oil companies in the world.
There's an expression called peaking that's very important to what we're talking about. What does that mean?
Peak oil is kind of a phrase that you're hearing more and more in the oil world. And what it basically means, and this is kind of crucial to understanding why there are so many questions about Saudi Arabia and indeed other oil producers, what it means is that basically when a country's reserves or any particular reservoir are about half depleted, what happens is, even though there's still 50% of the oil underground that remains there, what happens is that you can no longer continue, for geological reasons basically, you can no longer continue increasing the amount that you extract from the reservoir, because oil reservoirs are not like kind of, you know, lakes of oil underground with which these wells are like straws that you suck the oil out of. In fact, oil really exists as little drops between and within porous rocks. It's extremely difficult, actually, to extract from these reservoirs. And when you reach this halfway point with about roughly half of the oil out of a particular reservoir, at that point, and this is where this phrase peak oil comes in, you're no longer going to be able to continue increasing the amount of oil on a daily basis that you produce from this reservoir. And the kind of question that exists right now, and there are a number of people who suggest this, including a Houston energy banker named Matt Simmons, the question really is, have Saudi Arabia's reservoirs peaked? Are they just about at the point where they can no longer produce increasing amounts of oil? And there's real kind of reason to at least look into it, if not believe that.
And Matthew Simmons, who you just referred to, he's the head of a company that advises energy companies on mergers and acquisitions. And what is he projecting about when the Saudi oil is going to peak?
Well, Matt Simmons suggests in this new book that he just published that basically Saudi Arabia is probably peaking right now. And Matt Simmons is quite an interesting situation because he is, you know, he's not some kind of wild environmentalist or kind of rogue economist or anything like that. I mean, he is part of kind of the ruling class of the oil world. He's an energy banker in Houston, very prosperous. And he went to Saudi Arabia in 2003 on a government-sponsored tour, kind of thing that the Saudi government throws all the time for investors and bankers. And instead of actually coming out of that visit really impressed with the Saudi oil industry, he had questions. And he couldn't get them answered by the Saudis or anybody, really. And so what he did is he looked into kind of these files that exist of kind of technological papers that have been written about some of the Saudi oil fields that nobody really paid any attention to. And he examined these, about 200 papers about the Saudi oil fields. He examined them, and he kind of came to the conclusion that, in fact, these fields are not in nearly as good health as the Saudis say. And he came out with a conclusion that the Saudis have attacked quite strongly, that in fact Saudi Arabia is peaking right now. And because Saudi Arabia is peaking, that means basically the world is probably at its peak, because Saudi Arabia, with a quarter of the world's oil reserves, pretty much determines where everything else is going as well.
So you've got one oil expert saying that the Saudi oil has already peaked. You've got another who used to be highly placed in the state Saudi company Aramco saying hasn't peaked yet, but likely will soon. And then you've got the Saudis themselves, the officials, saying, "Oh no, everything's great." So, how do you decide where the truth lies?
Well, you've got to look, you know, as with kind of, you know, all matters, whether economic or political, at what kind of the interests and incentives are of each side to maybe, you know, color their conclusions or their public statements. And the Saudis are in a real bind, because let's say, for example, that indeed there are limits to what they can produce. If they just all of a sudden announce to the world, you know what, guys, we're not going to be able to produce more than 12.5 million barrels a day. You're going to have to develop alternative energy sources. You're going to have to start conserving energy. Then two things are likely to happen, at least in the immediate term. One is that the price of oil, which is already quite high, will skyrocket even more. And the second, and for the Saudis, more troubling kind of result, would be that indeed there would be movements in America and elsewhere towards alternative fuels, government programs to investigate, to promote them. There would be movements towards conservation of energy. And the result of that, not immediately, but 5, 10, 15 years down the road, is that there very well indeed might be alternatives to oil. And the Saudis, who depend on income from oil to keep their country and their economy afloat, may no longer have this valuable resource that can't be replaced because there may be replacements for it. So they don't want to kind of kill the goose that lays the golden egg by telling people, hey, the golden eggs may no longer be there in a couple of years.
My guest is Peter Moss. His article about Saudi oil was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Moss. He's writing a book about how oil shapes global politics and the world economy. His article about Saudi Arabia's oil and whether it can keep meeting our demands was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. You say it might take 10 years to prepare for a time when oil demand exceeds oil output. Congress just passed a new energy bill. What does that bill set in motion to help prepare for oil problems in the future?
Most of the people who I've talked to about the energy bill and how well it kind of begins to prepare us for the future tend to agree that the energy bill really does very little to prepare America for a future in which there might be shortages of oil. Because really there are kind of two key things that need to happen. Pretty much everyone that I've talked to agrees on, which is that there needs to be more conservation of the way that we consume oil. And there also needs to be more development and really assertive development of alternative fuels. I mean, of course, there are alternatives that exist, but they haven't been proven yet to be economically viable, or if they have become proven to be economically viable, they haven't been scaled out to the size that's necessary for them to play a major role. And the energy bill really doesn't go very far in that. On just the issue of, for example, conservation, really, everybody who you would talk to in the energy world agrees that one of the key things that America needs to do is increase the fuel efficiency of its automobile fleet. And the one thing that is actually lacking from the energy bill that was just signed by the president is a mandated increase in the fuel efficiency standards for American cars. That was one measure that everybody was saying, look, it would make a great amount of sense to do. Does not exist in the energy bill. Another kind of reform that a lot of people think is necessary, which would be very painful for Americans, is that the price of gasoline would need to rise in order to indeed promote conservation. By virtue of taxes on gasoline, greater taxes than exist now. Americans pay maybe half of what Europeans pay for gasoline. A gasoline tax is something that really is one of the many third rails that exist in American politics. In the presidential campaign in 2004, President Bush accused John Kerry of being in favor of gasoline taxes. Kerry was not in favor of gasoline taxes during this campaign at all, even though, many people say that's exactly the kind of hard medicine that America needs to begin to swallow.
How could a gasoline tax help conserve energy?
Well, a gasoline tax has a very straightforward effect on energy conservation. If you make gasoline more expensive for people to consume, they're going to probably consume less of it. Already at nearly $3 a gallon in some places, gasoline is quite expensive. If you, slap an additional tax on it, it's going to become more expensive and people will drive less. That's going to make their lives a little bit more difficult, particularly for people who really rely on their cars. If you live in the suburbs, if you're a trucker, things of that sort, it's very painful. But it's also something that would lead to greater conservation. And that's why there's a fair number of people who think that it's something that should be done. But it is indeed extremely difficult for any politician in America to really aggressively promote it. Because you know, one of the last people who did aggressively promote conservation measures and painful ones for this country was Jimmy Carter, who called for the moral equivalent of war in order to make America free of dependence for oil from foreign sources. And of course, we all know what happened to him. You know, he was not reelected. There were many reasons why he was not reelected, but a large number of people do believe that some of the reasons he was not elected was because indeed he was calling for national sacrifice in the way of energy conservation that people just did not want to have in their lives.
When President Bush talks about our oil future, he talks about the need to drill in the Alaska a National Wildlife Refuge. How much would that add to the oil that we have access to?
The Alaskan Wildlife Refuge has, nobody knows exactly, but a rough figure that people agree on is about 10 billion barrels of oil. Not insignificant, but when you compare it to, for example, to Saudi Arabia, which has reserves of about 260 billion barrels of oil, it's pretty small stuff. Now, because it's unlikely that vast new reservoirs of oil are going to be found anywhere in the world, reservoirs that contain 10 billion barrels of oil are going to have to be part of the solution, interim solution at least. If you need more oil and, you know, there are only little 10 billion barrel fields here or there, most people will say, well, then that's what you got to go with. Now, you know, of course, the 10 billion barrels that we're talking about are in Alaska. They're in a wildlife refuge, and there are very good reasons to not drill there. One of the things that some people have pointed out to me, and I've traveled around and visited a lot of oil sites in Africa and elsewhere, is that there are a lot of nice tracts of land in Amazon countries, in Ecuador and Brazil, in African countries that I've been to, in Nigeria, the Niger Delta, which used to be just an amazing, amazing source of wildlife. That have been and that are being affected quite severely. And, you know, one of the kinds of interesting and less talked about aspects of the debate about the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge is if we don't get the 10 billion barrels of oil from there, it's going to come from somewhere else. And in some respects, you're kind of exporting the problem or outsourcing the environmental problem. Because there are very few places on the planet where oil exploration is conducted where there is not environmental damage of, in many cases, environments that are quite precious. And so, you know, personally, I just wish people kind of understood that a bit more.
I know a lot of people wonder, do the high prices of gas and oil today have anything to do with the war in Iraq? Is there any evidence that there's a connection between the two?
Oh, well, there's definitely a connection between the two because, you know, one of the hopes in terms of the effects of the war in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq, would be that after Saddam was thrown out, there would be a lot of investment in the Iraqi oil industry. And Iraq has something like 110 billion barrels of oil underground. And Iraqi oil production would just, you know, double or triple or something like that. If that had been the case, maybe we'd be in a slightly, or we should be in a slightly better situation right now in terms of the amount of oil that would be available and the price. But because that's not the case, because in fact, after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the production of oil in Iraq, you know, kind of has been just limping along and hasn't really returned to its previous levels, let alone kind of increasing above them. We're in the situation now where you know, there's a shortage and where Iraq is in some respects part of the problem. In the sense of not being able to produce the amounts of oil that the rest of the world wants. And nobody thinks that that's going to change anytime soon. You know, even if tomorrow Iraq turned into a peaceful country where there could be kind of productive investment and new exploration, it would be years and years before any of that would result in really greatly added amounts of oil coming out of the ground. It takes, you know, projects in the oil industry to kind of from start to finish, from when you start drilling to when you actually get oil out of the ground and send it through pipelines. So those are usually projects that take years and years and you know, billions and billions of dollars.
What kind of national conversation do you think we need to be having about the future of oil, the future of our oil use?
I think the conversation that needs to happen needs to focus on the fact that the time when the amount of oil that we're going to need on a daily basis very likely will not be available, we need to focus on that issue and know that in order to prepare for that moment, we probably have to start now, because developing and scaling out alternative energy sources, whether they're environmentally friendly, you know, solar power, wind power, whatever, or whether they're not environmentally friendly, nuclear power, the scaling out needs to begin now, because even if this point when there's not enough oil on a daily basis to supply our increasing demands, even if this is 15 years off, it's going to take 15 years to prepare for that. And if we don't prepare for that, we're going to be facing an incredibly painful time where the situation that prevailed in 1973, when there was a boycott by the Arab members of OPEC, that situation, painful as it was, will probably seem like, you know, a mere pinch compared to what would happen if there were not enough oil, not just for a temporary period of time, but for time until there's no more oil left at all. We probably need to begin preparing for that now.
Peter Moss, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Moss's article about Saudi oil was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. He's writing a book about oil. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including Masterpieces of Western Music, Classics from the Baroque to the Modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lucifer's Shadow, a novel of passion and danger set in Venice by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mustang Sally. Coming up, we talk about new developments in auto design and fuel efficiency with Mark Phelan, auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Mott the Hoople. What I said. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Summer vacation season is driving season, and gas guzzlers have been guzzling money at the pump. The price of gas may be changing the priorities of people shopping for a new car. We invited Mark Phelan to talk with us about the latest developments in fuel efficiency and in car design. Phelan is the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. He's covered the auto industry for various publications for about 20 years. Is there any one thing that you would point to as the most interesting development in the auto world now?
Well, from my point of view, it's the return of the love affair with the American car. And I don't mean American in the sense of where it is manufactured, but sort of the classic formula for what kind of car Americans liked, something with a lot of room, with a big engine, and a reasonable price. And the perfect example of that at the moment is the Chrysler 300, which hit the market last year and took it by storm. And it is, in a lot of ways, it has all of the latest technology to give it good fuel efficiency and to make it very practical and reliable. But it combines all of those things with the virtues of the old American cars in that it is very affordable and it's got more room and more power and in many ways more style than anything that you can buy for a comparable price. And you see now Ford catching on with some of the same buzz with the Mustang that they introduced, which goes back to a formula that's been successful for them in the past. And it appears that GM is moving in that direction as well.
I'm told that the new Mustang was designed with Steve McQueen from the Bullitt era in mind.
It was, and it's incredibly successful. The first time that I drove the Mustang, I walked up to it with no particular sense of anticipation because I thought I knew what a Mustang was and I didn't think it could surprise me. And I got about 5 feet away from the car and I saw a reflection in the windshield and I would have sworn it was Steve McQueen. They absolutely nailed it.
But let's look at how the hybrids are performing now. How long have they been on the market? Like how much of a track record do they have so far?
The first one went on sale in the United States about 5 years ago, and the numbers so far have been small. I believe last year all of the hybrids put together sold about 60,000. The people who have bought them have been absolutely delighted with them, and there's no question that they do provide a significant increase in fuel economy compared to a similar vehicle that has a gasoline engine without the electric power plant. The technology is moving into some other parts of the market now, and I'm going to be very interested to see how that works because small cars like the Toyota Prius, which is the poster child for hybrids, as well as being fuel efficient, they make a statement when you see them. And a lot of the people, I believe, who were buying them liked it for the aura that went with it, that they are doing something good. Now companies are trying to put hybrids into more mainstream vehicles, SUVs and mid-size sedans. And I'm going to be fascinated to see if that more bread-and-butter part of the market is also willing to pay the extra $3,000 or $4,000 that the system costs. Because so far, while the fuel economy is a great improvement compared to a straight gasoline engine, even at today's high gas prices, you're not going to recoup the expense of the hybrid system over the ownership period. So there's got to be an element of social consciousness as well as economics for people to, I think, get their money's worth out of a hybrid.
So you've done a lot of test driving of the hybrids, and in one of your columns you talked about sometimes to get the maximum mileage out of a hybrid, you have to change some of your driving habits. What habits do you have to change?
Well, you have to do many of the same things you would to improve fuel economy in any car. You have to accelerate slowly and carefully. You have to decelerate early, just take your foot off the accelerator well before you need to if you're just going to be coming up to a stoplight and braking. And with hybrids in particular, learning a light touch on the gas pedal allows the electric motor to move the car without the gasoline engine being involved at all. And figuring out just the right way to use to use the gas pedal is very important. And the owners, especially the early owners of the hybrids, take great pride in doing that and in the fuel economy that they get. And if you change your habits in all those fashions, you really can get some pretty astounding fuel economy out of them.
Meanwhile, the Bush administration is expect to give up its proposal to extend fuel economy regulations to Hummers and other cars in that category. What's the story behind this?
Oh, that's a great little loophole. It got its origin back when fuel economy rules were first being put out, and there were no SUVs that people used just to drive around town that weighed 8,500 pounds or more, which is what you're talking about when you get into the size of a Hummer. The only vehicles that size then were big commercial vehicles, and, you know, things that farmers would use to, you know, haul hay, you know, to the barn, you know, things that were purely used for business purposes, and they didn't want to penalize those people. But as SUVs got bigger and as people developed a taste for things like Hummers, these mega SUVs came along, and it just so happens that they're so big that they fall outside of the area that the EPA even tests for fuel economy, and that is a substantial benefit to them, and it looks like they're not going to be losing it.
Let's look at the other end. What's happening with the mini cars?
You know, it's amazing. The conventional wisdom for years was that you couldn't sell tiny cars in America, and Mini came out with the Mini Cooper, and they're selling everyone they can build. Toyota launched a line of, you know, very small cars called Scion. They're selling very well. And the unifying thing about all of these small cars is that they're good-looking, they're inexpensive, and the people who buy them are getting a full package that offers them all of the comfort and all of the safety features that they would get in a larger car at an affordable price.
What kind of safety features are there in the mini car? Especially, you're likely to feel more vulnerable in a smaller, lower-to-the-ground car.
Yes. The Mini Cooper, for instance, they're very proud to point out that it's 11 feet long and it has 12 airbags in it. It's the only vehicle on the road that's got more airbags than feet of length. And all of the small cars are being designed with anti-lock brakes, with stability control, which helps in slippery conditions. Airbags are becoming ubiquitous on virtually all vehicles. And the science of designing the structure of the cars has become much better, so that even if you are in a very small, relatively light car, you've got a better safety cage around you than you would have if you were in, you know, an old VW Beetle or, you know, one of the early compact cars that were sold.
What are some of the innovations in the actual driving systems of cars that might be filtering down to, most of us consumers sometime in the near future?
There are several very, very significant ones. The best one that I've come across in the last 10 years at least is what they call electronic stability control, which senses how each of the wheels are doing and essentially makes it impossible for you to slide off the road if you hit an icy patch. It's just a miraculous system, and I think you're going to see that working its way into cars throughout, you know, the price range. Another real interesting thing that is affecting fuel economy in a good way is that companies are figuring out how to shut off a part of an engine when the car doesn't require all of the power from it. You know, the V8 in the Chrysler 300, for instance, if you're cruising on the highway, you know, at 65 miles an hour, it shuts down four cylinders so that you're effectively driving a car with half the size engine, and that improves fuel economy ratings by something on the order of 20%, if I remember correctly. And that kind of thing is going to be moving into SUVs in the near future, and the car companies hope that that will address some of the fuel economy concerns there.
My guest is Mark Phelan, the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Phelan, and he's the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. He's covered the auto industry for various publications for about 20 years. We were talking earlier about the new hybrids and new SUV hybrids. In Europe, diesel-powered cars are very popular. And of course, diesel fuel is a lot cheaper than the gas that we use. How come they've caught on in Europe and never really caught on here?
Largely because Europe has always had a tax system that favors diesel. I mean, gasoline is so much more expensive in Europe than it is here. And while diesel is expensive, it'll cost you, you know, a dollar or $1.50 less a gallon in some countries in Europe. So that's a very significant incentive. And there's also the fact that back during the fuel crises, you know, of the 80s, Ford and General Motors tried to get into the diesel business with their cars here, and they built some incredibly bad engines with poor reliability, terrible performance, and they pretty much ruined the name of diesels with the general American public.
So you don't think diesels will ever be catching on here?
Well, I think actually that was long enough ago that there's a new generation that doesn't remember any of those miserable old cars that, you know, broke down and smoked on the side of the road. And the new diesel technology that they've developed in Europe provides excellent power and very good fuel economy at the same time. And there's a small, loyal audience for that technology here in the States. It's a question of whether it crosses the gap to the mainstream. The first potential test of that is the Jeep Liberty, which added a diesel model this year. And they had planned, if I recall correctly, to sell 5,000 of them by the end of the year. And the last I saw, they had sold 9,000 in the first 3 or 4 months. And people are lined up to buy more of them. So there does appear to be some audience for it. It's just a question of, you know, how large it will become.
There's something called biodiesel cars. What's the biodiesel?
It's diesel fuel that is made from renewable organic sources, generally. It could be soybeans, it could be corn, it could be almost anything. And every Jeep Liberty diesel that rolls off the assembly line is filled up with a tank of biodiesel. There's no petroleum products involved anywhere in the process, so it's something that is one of the alternatives people are looking at as a way to reduce dependence on oil.
What's the upside and downside of this natural diesel fuel?
Well, the upside is that you don't have to, you know, worry about, you know, where oil comes from and all of the environmental, you know, problems that are inherent in producing oil. The downside is essentially cost. It is a little bit more expensive to produce the biodiesel than it is to, you know, drag it up from the ground and distill oil. But it's an intriguing move, and in fact, in Europe, there are some countries that are moving towards very significant incentives for people to use other vehicles that have got biofuel. Sweden is just moving into a huge push for ethanol-fueled vehicles.
Don't a lot of cars now look exactly the same? You know, just the styling of them on the outside. I'm not a real, you know, car aficionado, but I often find it hard to tell one car from another, to tell a cheap car from an expensive car. They're all kind of similar. Not all of them, but lots of them. Yeah.
No, there are a lot of them. They became a commodity, and that's one of the biggest problems that the traditional American car companies had. They were so far behind the pace on fuel economy and reliability that they mistook reliability for blandness. And we got a generation of pretty bland-looking cars. And all of the car companies now, you see this, you know, both at the American companies and the major Japanese players, Toyota and Honda in particular, all of them are working to find a way to make more distinctive, more stylish cars that you can recognize, you know, at 100 yards away and know exactly what it is. Because once quality ceases to become the determining factor for people when they're buying, then style and emotion come into play. And these companies forgot that they were in the emotion business for a while.
You've been covering the auto industry for about 20 years. What are some of the most interesting changes you've seen in that time?
The most fascinating thing of all to me has been that for most of 20 years, the traditional American Big Three were working incredibly hard to squander the loyalty that they had built up among their customers for the 60 or 70 years before that. And, you know, they were building cars that did not have much appeal, that were not competitive, you know, on price or quality. And the thing that has amazed me is that over the last 4 or 5 years, as brands like Cadillac and Chrysler have come out with vehicles that have the looks and the substance, that consumers have run back to them eagerly. I would never have guessed that there would be that big a reservoir of goodwill for these brands. There's also the incredible growth in the truck side of the business. I mean, 20 years ago, a truck was a pickup, and you drove a pickup if you were a farmer, a plumber, a carpenter. Today, a truck is everything from a little $14,000 pickup to an $80,000 Mercedes SUV. And people in every imaginable walk of life drive them, and they think of them as their car. They don't make the distinction between a truck and a car the way people used to. It's all one market as far as they're concerned. They're looking for the function that they want, and the labels have ceased to matter very much.
Is this a good time of year to buy a new car?
I would say the best time is the dead of winter.
Why?
Because December and January, nobody wants to be out walking in the parking lot at a dealership. If you live in the northern, you know, two-thirds of the country, it's just a miserable time to be, you know, shopping for a car, and the car dealer's business is much slower then, and particularly in December, every car company has got sales targets that they set for the year. And if they're 10,000 units short, they'll do whatever it takes to get that 10,000 sold. So December is when a lot of times you'll see really good deals because some manager has to reach the goal that he set himself at the beginning of the year. This is a good time, but because of the incredible success that the employee discounts have had over the last 2 years, August would traditionally be the time when there's a lot of the previous model year sitting around and they'd want to move those out. But inventories are so low right now that it's difficult in a lot of cases to find the car that you want because they sold everything over the last 6 weeks.
How successful have the employee discounts been, and what's the reaction being among actual employees? Because they were no longer getting a special benefit by being an employee of the car company.
They've been successful, I think, beyond anybody's wildest dreams. And most of the employees, I think, are smart enough to realize that in the long run, it's better for them if the company sells more cars, even if everybody gets the same deal that used to be just specially for them.
Mark Phelan, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Terry.
Mark Phelan is the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Motha Hoople. This is Fresh Air. A rock historian, Ed Ward, says that for a lot of people, Motha Hoople was one of the bands that made the early 70s bearable. Ian Hunter's self-conscious but knowing songs about the rock and roll life and the group's almost self-mocking stage presence were rare fun in the days of serious progressive rock.
I changed my name in search of fame to find the Midas touch. Oh, I wish I'd never wanted then what I want now, twice as much. We crossed the mighty oceans and we had a few divides, but we never across the motion, for we felt too much inside. You know all the tales we tell, you know the band so well. Still I feel somehow we let you down.
Once upon a time in the mid-60s, there was a bunch of English guys with a band called the Doc Thomas Group who went to Italy in search of fame and fortune, playing around and even getting to make a record there. They sounded like this.
Everybody get on your feet. You make me nervous when you're in your seat. Take off your shoes and tap your feet. We're doing a dance that can't be beat. We're barefootin'. We're barefootin'. We're barefootin'. We're barefootin'. Went to a party there.
Italy, though, wasn't a great place to get rich, or even to get paid. So the band returned to England, changed their name to Silence, and recorded a demo, which they sent to producer Guy Stevens at Island Records. Stevens offered them a contract, but told them their lead singer, Stan Tippins, wasn't rock star material. So they placed an ad in Melody Maker, and after auditioning a few no-hopers, they tried a friend of the guy in whose studio they were recording. Ian Hunter Patterson had been a journalist, a factory worker, and had played with dozens of bands in England and Hamburg, and wasn't too keen on auditioning for Silence. In fact, he'd never heard of Island Records at the time, one of England's most successful labels, but he did it as a favor to his friend. On the way, he bought a pair of cheap sunglasses to hide what he felt was his fat face. Guy Stevens loved him. The other guys, except for Stan Tippins, were afraid of him. But he was hired, and now all the band needed was a name. Somehow, Stevens came up with Mott the Hoople, the title of an obscure novel by American writer Willard Manis. Next, they went into the studio.
Leave me good. Move on down the road. You let me when he couldn't such a
Guy Stevens, their producer, was a man of very definite opinions, and he decided that Mott the Hoople was going to be his Dylan band. Certainly Ian Hunter, he dropped his last name, sounded like Dylan, enough so as to confuse people, who in 1969, when Mott's first album came out, were eagerly waiting to hear what Dylan was up to. A band covering Doug Somm's Crossroads and Sonny Bono's Laugh at Me in Dylan-esque style was sure to be noticed. But the other thing about Guy Stevens was that he had serious alcohol and drug problems, and so the band demanded to make their second album without him. It flopped, so Island imposed Stevens on them for the next two albums, which sounded terrible and also flopped, although they were beginning to get a following in the States. Finally, in March 1972 in Zurich, Mott was arguing so much they agreed to break up. Their bassist, Overend Watts, had heard David Bowie needed a bassist and went to audition. Bowie was horrified. One of his favorite groups had split, and he'd just written a song he was sure could be a hit single for them. Watts listened to the demo and took it to Hunter, who knew Bowie was right. With help from Bowie's management, they got out of their deals with Island and Guy Stevens, signed with Columbia, and released the song. Mott the Hoople was back.
Speed jive, don't want to stay alive when you're 25. And when you're stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks, and Freddy's got spots from ripping up the stars.
from his face, funky little boat race. The television man is crazy, Sam with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV when I got T-Rex. Oh brother, you can't have a dude last.
Oh, the young dudes.
Hey, dudes.
Carry the news.
Where are you?
Boogaloo dudes.
Stand up. Smile.
Carry the news. Oh, the young dudes.
I want to hear you. All the young dudes also took off in America, and the band undertook a major tour there, with Hunter keeping a diary that's since become something of a rock book classic. I saw them quite a bit during that period, and I'm happy to report that when they played All the Young Dudes, since nobody could hit the high notes in the chorus, they set up a mic in the wings so their road manager, who could hit them, could sing. His name was Stan Tippins. The revitalized Mott the Hoople continued through 1974 and then called it a day. Guitarist Mick Ralphs showed up in Bad Company, and the others went on to everything from farming to avant-garde performance. And Ian Hunter's still doing it, with an energetic young band, bad sunglasses, and a bunch of unusually insightful songs.
Our rock critic Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He'd like to thank Ian and Trudy Hunter and Angel Air Records for their help in getting some of the music we heard. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, putting 6 feet under to rest, we talk with the series creator, Alan Ball. He wrote and directed the final episode. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.